There it is. Excellent. How are you doing, man?
Good, good. Sorry about that. Having a Kit Kat break.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine. He's like, damn it, he caught me at the last minute. No, man, it is very nice meeting you. And just for the audience, and I want to make sure I get this right. And I'm going, well, not going blind, but at the very least, my eyesight has been diminished. Stanislav Kapravnik. Am I getting that correct?
Gropivnik.
Excellent. I've been practicing all morning.
Or just Stas for short.
Oh, Stas. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Stanislav, he is a former U.S. Army officer, supply chain executive, and military political expert, now based in Russia. He was born in Lugansk, which is something I want to go back to, by the way. During the Soviet times, migrated to the United States as a child, served in the U.S. military, did not like what it was doing in former Yugoslavia, quit and returned to Russia. Mr. Kapravnik is an independent contractor and consultant and appears in international media in his areas of expertise in military matters, NATO, America, history, economics, supply chains. And he has a channel on YouTube that all of you should go watch. So, Stas, thank you for this, man. I really appreciate you reaching out to me. When I had the opportunity
No
to work, I was like, oh, this is going to be a great interview. This is going to be a great interview.
I do have to correct one thing to have on there.
Please.
Yugoslavia was an element of it, but the real reason I decided to end military career in '99, I became an I was a captain in Dragon Brigade, which is 18th Airborne Corps Headquarters Brigade, and I was in G3. G3 is operations. Except for the very short period of time we were planning operations against Baghdad, the entire time we were planning operations against Russia. So that was this is when George Bush Jr. was looking into Putin's eyes and going, "Oh, I saw his soul, and we'll work together and all that." Meanwhile, we're preparing for war. So that was that didn't sit well. I got out. Now I got out in 2004, which is a few years later, but that's because that's when my contract expired and I had an opportunity to leave.
Okay.
Army practice is what's called needs of the army. So it doesn't matter what your contract says. If your MOS, your military skill set, is in need, they don't let you out. You sometimes you'll retire before they'll let you out. So it doesn't
Wow.
matter if the contract's expired for years on end. So that's just the way they practice.
Wow. So you can imagine people getting multiple rotations, even when they
Oh
think
yeah.
there's wow, that's
Oh,
amazing.
one of the reasons you have such a big problem in the U.S. now with suicides, with drug addiction, and veterans. I've known guys that went six, seven, eight rotations into Afghanistan or Iraq. Because they're and the way that system works. I mean, when I'm talking rotations, six rotations, 6 years sitting in Iraq, and the way that the system works in this case. For Iraq and for Saudi Arabia, I mean, sorry, I'm sorry, Afghanistan and Syria, you're on a brigade level. A brigade has three battalions. One battalion's in theater, one battalion just came back, and one battalion's getting ready to go. Rotational system. So the battalion that came back, they can't go anywhere for a year. So what I'm saying is the battalion can't go anywhere for a year. Not the
Individual,
soldiers.
right,
So the
individual.
commander of the battalion that's getting ready to deploy goes, okay, so we need two captains, four lieutenants, five staff sergeants, a first sergeant, a couple buck sergeants. We need signals corps. We need military intelligence guy in this rank. Calls up the battalion commander, the brigade commander. The brigade commander calls down to the battalion commander of the battalion that just came back and goes, hey, we need this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. Send them over to from 1st Battalion to 3rd Battalion. So guys that just got back, and all of a sudden they're being told, well, and off you go to the next battalion to go right back in. And
Wow.
people end up getting recycled into the area, and people wind up going nuts, and they wind up getting drug addictions, because a lot of people came back from those areas with opium addictions, opioid addictions. They PTSD is PTSD. People don't want to admit they have PTSD, because if you admit you have PTSD, you drop a whole load of different career options are gone, like being a police officer, for example. You can't own firearms. There's a lot of stuff that comes with that. So people won't admit it. They won't get help when they need it. And additionally, and you know, the morality thing is the difference between Vietnam War and even and Russia's Afghanistan, well, Soviet Union Afghanistan war, and something like World War II was World War II had clarity. You're fighting for a cause. You came back. You were the heroes. You know, people came back from Vietnam. They were getting spat upon. Russian soldiers came back from Soviet Afghanistan. They weren't getting spat upon, but nobody gave a damn. Soviet Union's falling apart. They were just forgotten. And that has a big morale hit. And you know, people, why was I fighting for whatever? You know, what I go through all of this. Nobody gives a damn about me, or doesn't, or they call me a baby killer or some of that. And that has a big effect. So these guys coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and you see what you're doing there, and it's not for the greater good of America or humanity, what have you. And then they go, you know, what the hell did I do all that for? Meanwhile, you spend enough rotations and your kids are calling somebody else daddy. So, you know, that's your marriage is gone and all that. And what the hell am I coming back for? That's a huge strain. And even coming out of the military into a civilian world is a huge strain. It's a massive strain. People don't realize that, because, you know, in the military, even if they don't know your name, they know your rank. So you already get a certain amount of respect. You know, you have responsibilities. You're somebody. You go in a civilian world and you're just another face in the crowd. And that's hard to take.
In the military, there's clarity. It's like,
yes,
there's clarity in a way that's not in a civilian world. You have to make your own clarity.
One of the hardest things I had to get used to, and I'm still not that great used to it, especially in the corporate world. In the corporate world, everybody toots their own horn, right? Everybody's self-promoting. In the military, it doesn't work that way, especially officer corps. You toot the horn, you promote the guys below you. The guys above you promote you. Look what that captain's done. That captain's great. He's done this. Well, that captain's going, well, look at my lieutenants. You know, my lieutenants accomplished this and this. So you're not the one that has to toot your own horn. You don't have to promote yourself to the higher-ups. In civilian world, and it's backstabbing. Everybody's out to backstab each other, and everybody's just promoting themselves. So that's something that's very difficult to get used to. You know,
there's a difference between working for profit versus working for a larger cause. Like, many, if all of us are together working for a particular cause, that's very different than me as an individual working to maximize my profit.
Oh yeah,
like it's absolutely, the model is different. Like, you know, ideally, in the highest aspiration, one is for country, protection of the homeland, that type of stuff. Again, I said in the highest aspiration. That's not the way it works. Right? but the highest aspiration of it all. No, I do get it. I do get it. And I'm glad you went this way with us, because it allows a pivot to the Russia-Ukraine war. Because I get the sense that this is seen as existential.
Yes.
B is seen as defense of the homeland, which means the spit on stuff doesn't apply. It seems to be getting compared to the Great Patriotic War, meaning the Second World War. That's what it comes across as from looking at this from America, looking at the way Russia seems to be, the way this looks. What is the state of that war? Well, first, do I have that right? Is that the lens that this is being looked at? Like, this is an existential war by the West, the United States, and NATO countries against Russia, using Ukraine as the tip of the spear in order to effect their will through a proxy. Yeah.
And the majority of people see that way. There were still some liberal elements that don't see it that way or would refuse to see it that way. Really? The majority of the liberal elements, by the way, the ones that the U.S. And the West were counting on to try to start a revolution in Russia, they're the ones that ran away during mobilization, which is funny, too, because, you know, all these IT guys, other people are running away from mobilization. They had no prior military service for the majority of them. They weren't even on the list. Nobody was interested in them. The mobilization, which is amazing. I know some of these guys that ran away. I was like, why? Nobody gives a damn. You know, the mobilization mobilized 3% of the reserve. The reserve is anybody who had any kind of military service. First thing they went for were guys that were back from Syria, places like that, had active combat service and experience. Then they went down to guys in combat arms that had, maybe they weren't ever in combat, but they had more or less fresh experience, then on down toward less and less. But they mobilized, like I said, 3%, maybe a little bit more. Out of, and just to get a feeling of it, people with military service in general. In Russia, that's 32 million. Mobilized 300,000.
32 million people in Russia have military experience?
Yeah. Now, that doesn't include, that doesn't mean they were contracted professional army.
No,
that
no,
means
no,
anything from many years to just doing their 1 year draft service. You know, that's from 1 year draft to guys that were professionally, you know, 20 years in and everything in between.
But that's overall, about the fourth of the country. Or am I wrong? Am I mad?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
That's a fifth of the country. Fourth and a half, somewhere around there. So we've got about 150 million people. They don't count. They're not counting the people in Crimea. They're not counting the people in the new old provinces of Novorossiya. But yeah, it's about a little over 150 million people. Overall, and we've got about 12 million could be labeled as Ukrainians. They're not really Ukrainians. Ukrainians are Russians, but we had 12 million people from Ukraine that are in Russia, that are part of Russia. Some of them came over with the territories. A lot of them ran this way either at the very beginning or already living here, or a lot of them went to Western Europe and then through Poland, Belarus, came into Russia. Roundabout to get in. I mean, there were in 22-23, because the front wasn't very stable. People were getting paid to, well, basically coyotes, getting people out of Ukraine and into Russia, civilians. Mm-hmm. And they knew who to pay off, or they knew the dead zones were, and they were getting people across. You can't really do that now, especially with drones. Drones have changed a lot of things.
Yeah, that's like a new doctrine of war. Yeah.
Well, for now. It's going to change too. There's technologies in the works that are going to, I mean, drones will never go away, but drones will not paralyze warfare the way they're doing it right now. It's you know, the best thing to compare it with, in 1914, you had the machine gun.
Right.
And, you know, there was an interview I read with a German machine gun team that wiped out a British infantry battalion in 3 minutes. And they stopped firing. They said, we can't do this anymore. This isn't war. This is just butchery. Because the British battalion stood up over the top, and off we go, running right into a machine gun that's just going zip, 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 zip. Ah, nobody's left alive. You know, 300 guys, 300 corpses are lying on the battlefield. But, you know, that stopped all movement. And then you wound up with airplanes, particularly airplanes, you know, went from recon to dropping bombs, first grenades, actual bomb, and then strafing. First they were shooting out of pistols, and they were actually shooting out machine guns. And then you wound up with tanks. So the technology moved forward, and it broke the stalemate. One of the technologies there's a lot of technologies to kill drones, including lasers that can take out a drone at 5 kilometers, so 3 miles for the standard bound, in half a second. It just melts right through it. But the problem is all these technologies, they serve us only one drone at a time. So,
drones being sent once.
Yeah, you get 40, 50 drones coming in from every direction. They're going to get through. That one laser system isn't going to be able to handle it because it's got to it lasers, then it has to recalibrate to the next target, lays it, next target, and it services one target. You get a bunch of drones coming in. That laser's a lot more expensive than the drones that are going to be taking it out.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Would you say, since we're on drones, that is the current state of the war, that for all intents and purposes, Russia is obviously taking kilometers. I mean, I think it was like 100 square kilometers over the course of the last few weeks. But that the drones are having some kind of impact on both sides.
Yeah.
Meaning in regards to Russian strikes, I mean, for God's sake, Russia just sent, what, like 600 drones, missiles, hypersonics, et cetera.
We're mixing two types of drones here. They're, it's all called drones. I'm talking about, in this case, you're talking about the drones that they're sending in are the Garand drones that started as a Shahed 1, and then you got the Garand 2, the Garand 3. The Ukrainians claim there's a Garand 5. I have no idea what the Garand 5 is. The Garand 3 has a reactive engine, so it's got a rocket engine on it. It's going so fast that most of the things that could take out the Garand 2 or better yet, the Shahed 1, they can't touch it. It just flies right past them at much higher velocity. And then there's the FPV drones, the small drones. And there's different drones for different missions. I mean, you've got recon drones. You've got the big, like Baba Yaga drones that can drop mines or grenades. You've got mining drones you'll settle a drone down, drop a mine on a road, and fly off. So you can remote mine a road. You've got drones that are used, the kamikaze drones. You've got drones that are used for resupplying troops. So you've got different kinds of drones, different kinds of missions. And that right now has, you know, from the Russian side, the majority of casualties are from drones.
I see.
From the Ukrainian side, the majority of casualties are still from artillery. Russia is using lots of drones, but Russia has massive superiority in artillery. And it had 7 to 10 to 1, and it's gotten just bigger. Russia's producing it, and the Western artillery is being destroyed. Particularly because the drones can go so far now, it's hard to hide artillery pieces. So Russia's got the superiority in artillery. So the majority of Ukrainian losses are still from artillery. Majority of Russian losses are from drones. And you know, all that video we see about the drones hitting and all that. You know, just to bring it to perspective, casualties, drones. That actually cause casualties are about 10-15% of the drones. The rest don't make it.
They're pinpricks.
Yeah, they're pinpricks. Well, on infantry, of course, you know, if you're the guy that drone's flying into, that's a pretty damn pinprick. Take your arm off, or you have to split you in half. I mean, they're carrying some of these bigger drones are carrying an RPG round on them. It's no longer a grenade or something. It's not a friggin' RPG round. You know, if it hits the human body, that human body just disintegrates into chunks. Going in every direction. That's a serious hit.
I guess when I meant pinpricks, I was more so referring to when it's hitting like buildings. Like it's not.
Right. Well,
Russian drones are basically going into are far more destructive in their capacities, as opposed to the Ukrainian drones seem to be much smaller in what they can deliver.
If it's tactical drones, where we're talking FPV drones. Depending on what, some of those drones, again, they're carrying an RPG round. You know, the guys are hiding in a house that flies into the window. You can take out a good chunk of that house out, depending how big of a round it's carrying. Now, if we're talking strategic drones, the Ukrainians build wooden airplane. Well, Ukrainians / Europeans, they're building wooden drones. And those drones are about 4 meters long, so about 12 feet. They're carrying about 50 to 100 pounds of explosives. So they can do quite a bit of damage. They're mostly hitting civilian targets. I wanted to get to this
because you're from Lugansk, and I wanted to get your take on the Soroblesk, the college that was hit, where they murdered all of those young people, or young girls. That is outrageous. Yeah. It's a terrorist attack by all stretch of the imagination.
In Kherson Oblast over last New Year's, there was a party in southern Kherson Oblast. There was a New Year's party. The Ukrainians struck it with four drones, one of them carrying an incendiary. There's like 30 people that died, including children, burned to death. We're dealing with a terrorist state, no better maybe worse. Well, maybe, I don't know, worse, but they haven't had a chance to be worse than Islamic State. And by the way, Ukrainian special forces, through their American and British curators and French curators, in this case in Mali, are arming and helping train the Islamic jihadists up and down Africa. And up and down in Syria, they were actively training these guys, the head choppers. So yeah, these guys do anything for money. They'll do the, you know, America, the American deep state moves. It's Islamic jihadists, it's Nazis, whomever. It moves them around. And by the way, you know who else they're training? There's a reason there's a lot of Colombians going through on the battlefield and getting killed. The cartels, the Colombian cartels and the Mexican cartels, are moving a lot of their soldiers through, cartel soldiers through the battlefield to get them real combat experience. And the Ukrainian military is also training the drone operators for the Mexican cartels and the Colombian cartels. And, you know, there was an article, I think it was Washington Post, that said, you know, 70% of the heavy weapons in the hands of the Mexican cartels on the border with the U.S. are all from Ukraine.
I'm not shocked. So, I'm not shocked by that. Yeah. Basically, arms depot.
Yeah. Guess who gets to fight the Ukrainian well-trained proxies? You know, the U.S. The taxpayer and the U.S. border guard is going to be up against guys that the U.S. government's proxies help train. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't. When Jelani came to the White House, shook Trump's hand. Oh, and Trump is like, oh, this is a great guy. And you think to yourself, all the people who are fighting in the U.S. military, and Trump is bringing this guy to the White House. It's just, it's outrageous.
You know what my comment was? I was on RT. My comment on that was, did Trump wash the blood of little children off his hands or lick it off?
Yeah. Yeah. These people are psychopaths. Agreed.
They are. They've killed Americans, by the way. I mean, the guy had a $10 million bounty on him, but now he's Trump's guy. He plays basketball with the command of CENTCOM. You know, Petraeus basically almost does a fellatio on him on stage.
Well, he was like, hey, have you been eating okay? I was like, are you serious right now?
I was waiting for him to get behind, on his knees, between his legs, and just start servicing him. I mean, my God.
Zip. Are you okay? Are you okay?
Have you had opportunities to kill little children lately? I mean, have you beheaded anybody lately? I mean, just for relaxation's sake.
Well, he just did that in his youth. He just chopped it in his youth.
A year ago.
It's like, yeah, it was just a phase I went through. It's like something.
I'm a different man now than a year ago. My wife does the head chopping now.
By the way, since you mentioned the European theater in this, let me back it up. As you pointed out, Europe is instrumental in making these drones in order to ship these drones into Ukraine in order to kill Russians. Not to mention their airspace, and not to mention it's very possible that they were using, let's say, especially the Baltic states, as staging platforms. Yep. Now, Russia has warned about the airspace. They warned about Latvia using this, in which case the Baltic states backpedaled. But obviously, just backpedaling is for a very short period of time. For whatever particular reason, Europe, after starting two world wars, is now on the brink of starting a third. And they don't seem to grasp, let's say, the gravity of what is taking place, or at the very least, they don't believe Russia's red lines on this stuff. Yeah. Explain to the American audience, and I guess two things. One, the gravity of all of these people being murdered at the college. And two, how close are we in the sense of Europe crossing a line? Because they don't quite seem to believe Russia's red lines on this. And I want to step further into this after you answer.
You know, I've been saying this on a couple shows lately. First of all, the European strategy is to mass manufacture these airplane-type drones. Before I go into this, let me explain gamification of war, because just to understand why they will attack anything and anybody, they have to kill somebody or something.
You talking about Ukraine?
The Ukrainian drone operators, even if it's a baby in a pram, they will go kill the baby in a pram. They get points for targets destroyed or killed first priority is, of course, expensive equipment, then military personnel, then expensive civilian equipment like telecommunication equipment or engineering equipment, then just civilian cars, preferably with people in them, of course, and then civilians. They have to kill somebody, and they get points for this. At the end of the month, they gather their points of whatever company or platoon or section, they gather their points, and they spend them on new equipment, on better swag, better provisions, and they do get bonuses on their pay or better food, what have you. And this is how the system, this is something that the West came up with and exported to Ukraine. It takes whatever little humanity is left in these drone operators on the Ukrainian side and kills it because they have got to earn points. So if their drone is flying out there, you know, and the battery is starting to die, and they've got no military targets, no engineering equipment they can hit. Oh, but look, there's a granny walking a baby. Ah, well, you know, hey, it's extra points. Got to get some points, and they will go for that granny walking a baby. This is what we're dealing with. This is why that drone wave that came into Moscow, and I could hear it, you know, from where I live. I could hear the booming going on. 137 drones. The vast majority of them were destroyed. There were, I think, like 7 or 8 drones that got through, and most of the drones that got through flew into apartment buildings. They can't get to the base because the bases are heavily defended. They can't get to the government buildings because government buildings are heavily defended. So they look for apartment buildings. Or one of the drones hit a two-story single-family house, killed 2 women in it, and buried a man in it that just took out the top floor. And the others, they all flew into apartment buildings. I mean, we've had my wife's got an acquaintance that was living in a neighbor, the next building over, and they videotaped that drone flying right in Zelenograd into one of the buildings, and she sent me that video. So yeah, they got to get something, they got to get some points. So, and if you go into a perfect example, you go into Gorlovka. So Gorlovka has been the front line for the last 13 years. It's been moved back a little bit, but it's there. I mean, I was there videotaping a section for RT at a market that just got hit an hour earlier. The guy, the guy's corpse was still laying behind me. They got his wife into a hospital. She'd lost her legs. And, you know, I'm videotaping this. Nobody else will come out there because they're too afraid, I guess. And there was a duel going on. There's still drones flying over it. And it had been hit by an artillery round, by 155-millimeter U.S.-made artillery round. And I'm sitting, you know, I'm standing there where we parked. We hit the cars in a courtyard. And you're looking at these apartment buildings. And just across the street is a field, and that's the end of the city. And that's the front line, basically. And there's an artillery duel going on between the American-made mobile artillery piece and a paladin and the Russian artillery. They're trying to locate each other and kill each other. But that paladin had hit this market, thankfully, right before the market opened. So there were just the vendors there. One vendor dead, his wife's legs torn off, and 2 other women injured. And like I said, we popped in an hour later to document it, and I also documented it for RT. Well, we parked the vehicle, our vehicles, in a courtyard. And you're walking around, and you look at these apartment buildings. They're not destroyed. I mean, the apartment buildings are solid, but they're burnt-out apartments all over. And what the Ukrainians will do is they'll take an FPV drone, they'll fly it up to this apartment building, they start looking in the windows. They're looking for people. They see somebody in that apartment, they slam that apartment with that drone and blow it up. The job is to kill civilians. Flat out, kill as many civilians as you can. And you're walking, and about a third of the apartments are burned out. You know, they see where the drone came in, blasted out, and went through the window, blasted the window out, and you know, killed somebody in there. And yeah, that's the reality. That's the reality for 13 years. And by the way, just to understand how hard it is to break Russians, that first of all, Gorlovka doesn't have water. It hasn't had water for 13 years. Because the mains have been destroyed by armor-piercing artillery rounds. Every time they get repaired, they get hit again. They hit the repair crews. Gorlovka had a population of 380,000 people before the war. Gorlovka has a population of 320,000 people right now. Almost no one left. Everybody came back. And the attitude is, this is our land. What the hell, we're going anywhere. And that's the Russian attitude. This is their land. They've been under fire for 13 years, and they're hardcore. I mean, they've had markets attacked by cluster munitions. If you go on the main street, main square, there's just a lot of scarring from cluster munitions in the asphalt. A lot of buildings have sandbagged areas, and you can see the scars from the various munitions. I came into Gorlovka, brought in with a friend of mine who unfortunately died in a car wreck coming back from Lugansk. He was bringing supplies back and forth, and he just fell asleep behind the wheel. God rest his soul. But we're there delivering, beds and diapers and things like that for people that have lost their homes, right, for their kids. And we're standing there talking, and you hear it around the cluster munitions about 500 meters away from us. And you can hear the bop, 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 bop as it's hit. Or, I go see an aunt, uncle of mine. They're elderly people in the Yasinovata. Yasinovata for the last year has been away from the front. The front's been moved back. But Yasinovata was another one of these. It's just up the road from Gorlovka, 30 kilometers. It was another one of these towns that for, 12 years it was being artillery. And as we're going to Yasinovata from Gorlovka, and we're going at about 150 kilometers an hour, so that's 90 miles an hour, on a road that's scarred with shell craters. We're just flying down this road. You can hear the artillery hitting behind us, because as soon as they have a drone that spots cars, they just start trying to hit the cars. But that's okay, because they can't adjust fire fast enough for a car going that fast. Now, the drones, on the other hand, they can go up to 100 miles an hour. That's a pain, because they will run down cars, civilian cars, and blow them up. And you see cars have been destroyed, pushed out of the way. And even Gorlovka, when we were going up to that market, we're going up the road of death. The road gets artilleryed. That way cars can't go very fast, and the cars get hit by drones. And they're just burned out cars everywhere. And we're a bunch of idiots in a big white Ford van just trying to... fly our way down there. God loves us.
9 miles an hour.
We're some idiots driving down there. It's like, God, we're going to get in there some fast.
I think your point is that they aim for civilians. Is your point?
Absolutely. And, I'm standing there talking to my uncle, and you can hear we're in his courtyard. I mean, he had a crater in his yard where they got hit. About a year ago, their neighbor got killed. It was the fourth time their house got hit, and she got hit that time. It's just, you're standing and you're hearing the artillery rounds. They just randomly fire artillery around here, artillery around there. You hear that 155 round flying over your head and hit somewhere further back. It's like, yeah, and everybody, they're all used to it. I mean, that's how it is. And in fact, we had a guy with us that had never heard artillery before, and he's getting real nervous. And I look over him, it's like, listen, Misha, the round that kills you, you're never going to hear it. So just relax. The worst probably thing you're going to send to a civilian. Like, we're going to leave. We're going to get out of here. It's like, calm down.
I wouldn't be freaking out. It better be me. I'd obviously be uneasy.
Yeah. it kills you. Welcome, Jesus.
It's like, you never hear it coming. It's like, chill out. If you hear it, it's okay.
You never hear it coming. Yeah, the ones you hear over your head zooming by, but they're not going to hit you. The ones that's got your name on it, you're not gonna hear it. It's just that's
I suppose the way that it is comforting on some level. It's like silent death.
Yeah. Again, a guy that's ever heard artillery fired in anger he freaked. He freaked hard.
I would imagine.
Probably the wrong thing to say.
to put it mildly. You were pointing out I think what you were going with this was pointing out that Ukraine is going after civilians. There's that. Yep. The weapons that the Europeans are effectively given are going after, especially when you have so many numbers of those things, they become much more difficult to shoot down. So you can shoot down 100, but can you shoot down 200, 300, which is what the Europeans seemingly are trying to do, to overwhelm the Russian defenses.
And here's where we come to the critical point, because most of what I was talking about are FPV drones. But now what hit Moscow were these airplane type drones. Some of them get up to the size of a Cessna, 12 feet in length, about 8 feet in width with a wingspan. their job, number one job, is for the Europeans, and this is a suicide mission. It may be a suicide mission for half of humanity, at least the Northern Hemisphere. Their job is to, A, overwhelm the Russian anti-aircraft systems, and B, what we see is to start hitting strategic targets. Strategic targets in this case, as they've tried before, is early warning radar systems, the strategic nuclear bombers out of the strategic triad, and probably, if they have a chance, try to hit submarines in port. Now, what you have, except for the U.S. and for Israel, which officially doesn't have nuclear weapons, but we all know they damn well do. Every other country with nuclear weapons has a second strike policy. You know, we are not going to strike first. If you hit us, we'll hit you back. But that's all good and great, except that when you have a nuclear superpower that's now blind, it doesn't have early warning radar. At the moment, at the maximum, it's going to have maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes notice something's coming in from localized radar. And that may be damaged and destroyed too. The nuclear logic, when across from you is sitting a nuclear power that has a first strike first strike doctrine, is you don't wait. You strike with everything you have now while you still have it, because you know you never know. They may be right now. They may be deciding to strike you first. So a blinded Russia, just like, by the way, a blinded America, is a nuclear holocaust. That's just how it is. That's the only logic of nuclear weapons. So you now have one of two choices. Either A, you don't do anything and you go to nuclear war, or B, Russia starts taking out those manufacturing facilities in Europe using conventional warheads, like the Oreshnik, and then just risk conventional war with Europe. And, you know, that's where we're at. That's pretty much where we've gotten to.
I get the sense that, and give me your analysis of this. In fact, I want to read what the Ministry of Defense wrote, and I want to get your take on whether or not this is a substantial change from the special military operation. And this is in response, or they're saying it, is it in response to the attack on, basically the terrorist attack that killed those kids. Mm-hmm. And so they point out, they said, right here, it says, this was the last straw. Under these circumstances, the Russian armed forces would be launching systematic strikes against the Ukrainian military industrial complex in Kiev, including locations where UAVs are designed and manufactured, programmed, and prepared to use. They also pointed out, they said the campaign also will be affecting decision-making centers and command posts. What's wild about this, up to this point, it seems that they avoided going after decision-making centers and focused on this kind of war of attrition with the idea of the special military operation. And I give Putin credit. He's very pragmatic. And I know there are a lot of people who've been on this channel, I think myself, maybe even included, that is looking at the pragmatism, or at the very least, the West looks at the pragmatism as weakness. And as you pointed out, crossing one red line after the next with the idea that Russia... Yep. Bluffing. What do you make of this? Is this a substantial change to the special military operation? And I guess
I hope so. But
so I'm not the only one who hopes so.
Well, on the flip side, yesterday we had from head of the Armed Services Committee, basically the Russian version of it. They stated, well, when we said that, we didn't mean we're going to hit the Rada or we're going to hit go after Zelensky. We're going after the decision-making, military decision-making. It was like, well, wait a minute. You're not fighting the military. You're fighting the government. The military is the tool of the government. Right. So in my personal view, take out the Rada, take out Zelensky, take out... You know, the difference here is, because people say, well, you take Zelensky out, the next guy comes up, or the next guy... No, this is different. You kill somebody in the Russian government, the next guy comes up. You kill somebody in the Iranian government, the next guy comes up. You kill somebody... Because they have their nation states with an ideology that people believe in. Ukraine is not really even a nation state. It is a mafia gangland masquerading as a country. Yeah. These people are there just to feed. Zelensky's not going to die of old age in Ukraine. Nobody around him is. Look, you know, Zelensky's parents live in a $7 million mansion in Ashkelon, Israel. His wife and kids live in a castle in England. he if the journalists were right about the Zelensky's holdings in the U.S., he's the ninth largest landowner, private landowner in the U.S. now. He's been buying up ranches in Montana. So, you know, you're looking at these people. You know, Emirov is a prime example. Emirov was spent 3 years as Minister of Defense and is now on a defense committee. Emirov and his entire family are American citizens since 2016. And I mean entire family. Mother-in-law, father-in-law, brother's family. They're all of them live in Florida. They're all U.S. citizens. Emirov is a U.S. citizen, too. He's got dual citizenship. And Emirov is the only one in Ukraine. He's there to earn, you know, steal whatever he can steal. They're buying up huge amounts of properties in Florida, in Miami. That's where they live. And they're all the same. So if the moment it becomes expensive for these crooks, and I mean expensive as, oh, crap, they might kill me. This isn't fun anymore. There's no idea they're willing to die for. There's only their pocket. So the moment it becomes deathly dangerous and, you know, they're starting to get killed off, they're all run. They're not going to stick around and die for Ukraine. The hell with that. They're going to run. Look at Klitschko. Prime example, Klitschko, mayor of Kiev. He comes out there, you know, we got to lower the enlistment age. We've got to, you know, we've got to get more men in the military. Klitschko's got two sons, 22 and 23. Guess where they live? Well, sure as hell ain't Ukraine. They live in Hamburg. Hamburg, Germany. They're not going to go fight. Oh, hell no, they're not going to fight. This is the typical Ukrainian and European elites. You know, van der Leyen's got six kids. I'll give her that. She gave birth six times.
She was fruitfully multiplying. Yeah.
Yes, she was fruitfully multiplying. She was doing her demographic part for Germany. I'll give her that much. But, you know, she got asked, are your kids, you know, Germany's going to bring back a draft. Are your kids going to go serve? And she had that honest moment, you know, the Freudian slip. She's like, no. That's the whole point. It's for the little people, the dirty little people. Kids. You go fight. Yeah. You dirty people go fight. We are the light. We are the intelligentsia. We're not going to get our hands dirty and get our head blown off. Hell no. See, dirty little people, you know, you got nothing to live for anyways. Go fight. You know? So that's the European elite. I mean, that's the Ukrainian elite, absolutely. That's what you're doing.
Why do you think that the Russian, let's say, why do you think that Putin didn't go with this particular strategy or is using more so of a strategy of attrition? And it's for the most part shied away from hitting decision-making centers. Because I have a hypothesis. And I want to give it to you, but I want to hear yours first.
The Russian side, well, we know what happened at the very beginning when the Russian army came in to do two things. One, stop the Ukrainians from genociding Lugansk and Donetsk, because the Ukrainians outnumbered the Russian army by 2-1. They were in forward jumping off positions. They were getting ready to start the war, literally the next day. So the Russian military struck first. They were able to destroy a very large chunk of that military force, particularly in Lugansk province. But they were there to scare Zelensky into becoming neutral. And it almost worked. So they weren't there to destroy necessarily everything in sight. They were there to force Zelensky's neutrality. Right. And again, almost worked. After that... And you know, I came into the media at the beginning of 2023. Well, toward the end of 2022, I gave the first couple of interviews to some newspapers. Then I've been in Russia by that point. I've been back to Russia by that point 13 years. I was just working in oil and gas services and as a consultant. And I've been saying from day one, you know, the Kremlin's point is, they didn't want to act too irrationally and too blatantly because that may scare, or too aggressively, let me rephrase that, that may scare NATO into overreacting back. I'm like, okay. No, the opposite. You want to scare NATO shitless and get them at the table negotiate, you leave a pile of corpses. That they understand. We're not trying to kill too many of the enemy soldiers. We're trying to go steady. See, let's negotiate. They don't understand that.
They don't get that.
But the Kremlin does not. It projected its own values. We're not out to kill everybody. Onto the West, and without understanding who they're dealing with. And people like myself are saying, no, you're doing the wrong. You're doing the worst thing you can do. Scare the West out of their mind, and they will negotiate. And that they didn't want to do that. And then you get what you get. And, you know, when the first country to give tanks to Ukraine was Slovakia. Slovakia before Fico. Why Slovakia? Because that was a sacrificial lamb. Let's see what Russia will do. If Russia slams the crap out of Slovakia and starts bombing it, all of NATO is going to go, whoa, that's not us. That's those idiots in Slovakia that did it. We told them not to do it. But Russia didn't react that way. So everybody took a look and went, got it. Let's go. And the gates of hell open up. Absolute opposite of what should have been done. I think they've realized that since then, that this is what you're dealing with. But it took 3 years to realize that, come to that realization.
Yeah. So what I thought was that in the very beginning of this, as you point out, Ukraine outnumbered Russia 2 or 3 to 1 when they first went in. And is it possible that from the Russian point of view, they looked at it as, we're not in a position currently to take on all of NATO. We need time.
Yes.
And this, over the course of the 4 years, buying that time up to the point where they have 2 additional militaries with brand new kit, apparently. They have new missile systems like the Sarmat, Oreshnik, et cetera, the tsunami device, like these, basically these super weapons, these sci-fi super weapons. And now they look at it as, in a conventional war, we would win. Hence, Kiev is now fair game and Europe is on notice. Is that what we're looking at? Basically, that they needed time, they bought that time, and now they believe that they're in the dominant position compared to, let's say, European conventional military.
Honestly speaking, even back then, they were in a dominant position because while the Russian military is much smaller, the whole military isn't involved, never was involved, and still isn't involved in Ukraine. There's about 500,000 soldiers involved in Ukraine. But that, again, when, you know, Zelensky will say he's got a million-man army, but his army, they count everybody from police to medical emergency crews to everybody. That's
dog walkers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, dog walker. Yeah, he could be, you know, those could be lethal hounds of hell. We'll release the hounds of hell at that point. But the majority of the military in any country is not combat soldiers. You know, what? In the old days, you know, old days, I mean 120 years ago, 150 years ago, when I said I had an army of 100,000 men, I meant I had an army of 100,000 infantry, artillery, cavalry. And then I had a train of people, whether they're freemen or slaves or what have you, mostly were actually wives, camp whores, and so on, that, by the way, also did the cooking, the cleaning. They were they were driving the wagons with supplies and all that. This is whole armies move. There's a whole town that moved behind any major army, right? People don't talk about it very much, but that's the wagon train is what they called it. Your logistics background, while the soldiers did the fighting. Well, that was then. Now, all those people are in uniform. So when you say, for example, France has an army of 250,000 men, great. They've got about 20,000 or 30,000 that can actually fight. The rest are, you got your cooks, your truck drivers, your mechanics, your finance guys, you know, your lawyers, just like, you know, Lindsey Graham, combat lawyer extraordinaire. You know, you got the what we call the affectionately the ash and trash. This is the entire rear that does all the other crap. Some armies have more, some armies have less. You know, the U.S., I think, was getting up to 11 ash and trash to one combat soldier, which is ludicrous. But, you know, a lot of armies are somewhere in between 5 to 7 support soldiers for every combat soldier. You know, these are the guys that go to the theater of operations with a typewriter, not a rifle. This is all this combined. So when the European militaries are actually the combat capable portions are actually very, very small compared to even their small militaries. That's why the Germans, they're planning on bringing back the draft. But at one point, the Bundeswehr told them, you know, we can defend one city. choose, and not Berlin, that's too big. Choose the city you want us to defend. That's it. This is all we have left. I mean, the British Army has 140 serviceable tanks. That's not even a that's a brigade. That's less than a brigade's worth. A battalion is about 44 tanks. So you got three battalions. Yeah, that's a basically a brigade of tanks that can still roll. So you know, you start looking at these militaries in the West are a joke. The most combat capable NATO force on the continent was the Ukrainians, even though they weren't part of NATO. Right. But they were NATO trained, NATO equipped for the most part, or a lot more now.
Yeah.
So yeah, and NATO led, by the way, because the generals in Ukraine, they're the executioners of orders. They're not the planners of orders. These different campaigns, these different missions, they're planned by the British and the Americans. That's just how simple it is. The Ukrainian generals don't plan jack. They get told what to do, where to attack. They're just there to make things happen. So yeah, so that's the situation. And the right, you know, I'll tell you, while negotiations were ongoing, so you're talking the first 3 months, Russian soldiers were under strict orders not to fire until fired upon.
What? Yes. See, this is the part that confuses me. And maybe it's because I'm an American. And I know these people are psychopaths. I was born here. I was raised here. I know they're psychopaths. I hear, like, meaning it's not even the politicians. It's the media also in the way that they talk to the politicians. Basically, if they're not being hawkish enough, media would basically browbeat them. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Why aren't you doing so-and-so? Right? It's like, why aren't you taking back the Strait of Hormuz? It's like, because he can't, right? It's like, obviously, if he had the power to do it, he would do it. He's not doing it because he can't. And it's the same thing in Russia. It's like, hey, why aren't you telling Putin what to do? And it's like, because he can't. He has no cards in this. Yeah. He's losing the war. And yet the media acts as if, you know, the U.S. is in control. The U.S. is in charge. I can't believe the president isn't doing this or that. It's astonishing. When I was covering the Biden-Putin summit in Geneva. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was there, green around the collars, thinking to myself, oh, this is great. Russia and America are finally settling, or at the very least going to talk, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember Mindy was there with me, and Mindy was kind of like, whatever. Basically, nothing is going to happen. And I'm sitting here like, nah, man, they're talking. At the very least, it's a good thing. And Biden comes out, and he's sounding a lot like Putin in the very beginning. And the media seems confused by it and is effectively yelling at Joe Biden, like, did you read Putin Riot Act? Did you tell him this? Did you tell him that?
Did you bite his nose off?
Yeah.
Did you rip an ear?
It's the weirdest thing in the world, right? It's like, it's not just the politicians like Lindsey Graham are lunatics. It's also the media. Oh, yeah. These people are insane. And so I could have told them they're lunatics. They're psychopaths. They are not going to look at, we do not believe we are constrained by either law or by even agreements.
Oh, yeah.
And that has to be taken into consideration anytime the U.S. is negotiating, meaning whoever the U.S. is negotiating with. I just, God, man, I can't believe that. Yeah, and so they thought that they really was going to get a deal, or they thought that there was a possibility of a deal.
Oh, the deal would have been done. It was initiated. It was initialized, and it was awaiting final version to be signed. That's how close all of this could have been avoided. The Ukrainian side initialized everything. The deal was there.
Around before Boris Johnson.
Before Boris Johnson. Yeah, oh, yeah, before that fat slug with the goofy haircut showed up. By the way, you know, Boris Johnson was born in New York City.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I guess
he's got dual citizenship. Yep. He was born to British parents, but yeah, he was born in New York City.
he's American.
They couldn't find a decent barber in all of New York, or London for that matter, for that goofball. Yeah, when he was on the beach, my God, he looked like, when they had him in body armor, he looked like off of... There's these aliens off of Doctor Who. He just looks he just came off of a Doctor Who set. Oh my God, that's the worst. I mean, I wouldn't have that photo published of myself. But you know, everybody has their own. but mentally, but there's I don't know if it's true or not, but supposedly got about $1 million reward for getting that war kicked off.
Did it?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of people that made a lot of money or making a lot of money. But have you watched Senator Kennedy from Louisiana? Louisiana, you know, both senators from Louisiana are just idiots.
Senator from Louisiana.
Yeah, the Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, he's the white guy, and then there's also a black guy. Both of them are total idiots. You listen to these guys, like, can the state of Louisiana not find two better human beings than these two morons?
They can't.
The other guy, I cannot remember, Kenneth or Keith, something like that. He was the one that was afraid that Guam was going to flip over. Have you seen that video? That was from...
Johnson,
I think his name is Johnson. He's the second senator. He was questioning.
Oh, you mean Mike Johnson? Speaker of the House? Huh? You mean Mike Johnson?
No. Maybe it's not Johnson. I cannot remember the guy's name. He's the second senator from Louisiana. Now, this guy was, there's a famous video of him from these committee hearings. And there's a four-star admiral sitting there. He's talking about getting you're bringing in another brigade of Marines and their families onto Guam. And Guam, and he's doing this thing with his hands. Like Guam's like so far wide, and the admiral's like, well, sir, you know, I can't tell you exactly how many kilometers and all that, but or miles in this case. But you know, my people will give you the geographical statistics if you need to. You know, bring it to your officer. Well, yeah, but you know what I'm worried about? I'm worried with everything's on that side of the island. If you bring another brigade and their Marines and their families, that the island will flip over.
What? He said that?
Yes, he said that. And you're like, this is the U.S. Senate. My God. So let's flip forward now to Senator Johnson. He talks like a good country lawyer and all that, which is a fake act. I mean, the accent may be not fake, but he's not no good country lawyer, good old boy. The guy's pretty shrewd, but he's dumb. And he's dumb in that, you know, he's questioning the service chiefs for the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Eric Smith, and the head of the Navy. I can't remember the guy's name. And he's telling him, it's like, you know, and we're just beating, and the Ukrainians are just about to knock the Russians out, right? And he's like, well, yes, sure, yeah, the Ukrainians are about to knock the Russians out. And we showed Xi over there, Xi just showed that he's really afraid of us because, you know, we could just come over there and just beat the crap out of him. And you know, we did with that, you know, you just got your ass kicked by Iran. You're going to go against the Chinese. And the service chiefs are just like, well, yes, sir. Yeah, sure. We could go fight a war with China. We don't want to fight a war, but yeah, we could do it. Jesus. This is the U.S. Senate. These are this is the government.
They couldn't. Look, these people are idiots in general.
They are idiots.
But you have to realize that from their context, we are a hyperpower. And we are ensuring, like, it's very important for the world. Like, most of the world doesn't suffer under that delusion, right? Nope.
But they especially do. After Iran. No, they do not.
You would think that after, because what's wild to me about that, right, is they think that obviously Donald Trump is not a moral man.
Right? No. Not by any stretch of the imagination.
No, by no stretch of the imagination. He's a habitual degenerate liar that's a psychopath that started a war by murdering a bunch of schoolgirls.
Wait a minute. But he's according to the Christian Zionists, he's the anointed of God. And to go against the anointed of God is like to go against God himself. You know, Paula White. They were blessing his golden statue on whatever golf course down in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, you can't make this crap up. This is insane. But, you know,
it's bizarre. But that's the delusion to which they suffer under. So they look at Iran and think, well, that's obviously like Venezuela. It's like, dude, I wish you watched my channel. I would have told you that
wasn't 3-day war, man. 3-day war, maybe four if we're really unlucky. It'll be four, but you know,
40 days.
It amazed me in that they tried to decapitate Iran in July of that of 25. It failed. I mean, they killed a lot of people. They didn't fold the government. The next people in line just stood up and started running the government.
Right.
So for some reason, they now thought in 26 they would be able to do the same thing and win.
With the U.S. attacking directly.
Right.
They didn't even worry about the proxy. They just said, hey, we'll do it.
Yeah.
We'll do it.
Yeah.
It failed. Well, two things. I want to go to Iran first for just one question, but I want to get one more question on this. The NATO drawdown. So Donald Trump came out, apparently, or the Pentagon came out, and pointed out that they were drawing down in regards to a crisis for NATO. And they were taking substantial amounts of equipment and everything else in regards to if any type of crisis hits. Basically, NATO is going to have, or Europe is going to have to mind the gap with the United States being a backstop with this kind of division of labor, where Europe handles, quote unquote, supposedly handles the burden of the Russians in the way that they think about it. You get Germany popping its head back up, which is astonishing. So is Japan. Basically, the West or the United States is not above using lunatics, whether in Germany or Japan, in order to fight the Russians or, for that matter, the Chinese. What do you make of that? I mean, for one, as you pointed out, it doesn't seem like Europe can carry that burden.
No.
And yet you have these European leaders who seem to be very hyped up at getting people killed in a Russian wood chipper. Give me your thoughts on this. What is the point of this? What do you think this is going on here?
First of all, let's be honest. The European leadership hates its own people. I mean, it's not hard to see that. Second of all, and if you listen to them, look, you know, if you see posters of "We Are Europe," right? So you'll have a little white girl, you'll have an Arab guy, an African guy, you have an Indian or Pakistani guy. We're Europe. Now, time to defend Europe. It's all white guys. You know, the people are like, wait a minute, we're all Europe, why is only we have to go die and nobody else? But there's the second part of it. What are we fighting for? Gay parades? Bankruptcy? Lack of what are these European values? You know, so they're having problems with that, but they're trying to mobilize somehow the people.
Yes.
After having demoralized them for several generations. That's one. But I don't honestly see the U.S. fighting Russia. I see Europe fighting Russia in one way or the other. Look, you know, America, first of all, from the German side, a year and a half ago, the Union of German Industrialists proposed to the German government, you're going to love this, that they remove sanctions off of Russian industry so they could buy Russian steel, get Russian gas to manufacture and maybe get Russian gunpowder or gun cotton to manufacture shells to give to Ukraine to shoot at Russians.
I made the same argument, by the way.
that's ballsy. That's pretty ballsy.
And I was like, are you seriously expecting the Russians to sell you something that you're going to use to kill Russians? I thought it was the weirdest thing in the world when I was at the radio station. I was like, this can't be serious.
I mean, they could have just asked the Russians, hey, can you just manufacture some 155 millimeter rounds so we can just shoot them back? Right. Just give us the rounds. You know, that's ballsy. I mean, that's ballsy to ask somebody, hey, can you make the bullets I'm going to shoot you in the head with? And make the gun too while you're at it. You know, that's one. But the U.S. as a backstop, why don't the U.S. is ever going to fight Russia? Because why? The U.S. needs to make money, not lose people. You know, the first time I read an article on this theme was 1998, maybe 99. I'm pretty sure it was Forbes magazine, or back when Forbes was worth something. And they was talking about the U.S. needs another good war. You know, World War II often gets called the good war, not because they're fighting Hitler, but because it lifted the U.S. up from the Great Depression up into being 60% of world GDP. It was a good war. Yeah, it was a great war from that point of view. Well, you know, the elites were starting back in the U.S. elites back in 98, 99. They're starting to publish articles. And they must have been talking about this for at least a decade before, about how we need another European-wide war. You know, Russia wasn't quite in the position at that point for that. But they were starting to go, that's the direction we need to go. And flat out, because then we can write off our debts, issue credits, and rebuild Europe with another Marshall Plan and become stinking rich off of that. So 20 years later, you know, and Europe is in that position. It's ready to go be the sacrificial lamb. That's where we've gotten to. You know, they've been working on it pretty damn well. And the U.S. just in dry stock. The U.S. has about 2,500 M1 tanks, which are 105-millimeter cannons, steel armor. Has about 2,500 M1 A1 tanks, which are the 120-millimeter rounds, the second-generation 120-millimeter rounds, composite armor. Those are the ones I commanded. And, well, the M1 A2s, which are same thing, except they're not computerized, have a few more widgets in them. Those are on active duty. But the U.S. has about 5,000 tanks. And I'm not even going to the M60s. They probably got some M48 patents or sitting around somewhere, too. But, you know, they've got 5,000 tanks, main battle tanks. They got about 6,000 Bradleys. And now, from what I've been hearing, they've started to renovate the M1s to M1 A1 standards, putting in 120-millimeter rounds, changing up the steel armor for composite armor. Why would you do that? Why don't you just cut them up? What do you got? They're sitting around. You got to take care of them. You got to work the machine to make sure the engines turn over and all that, unless you're planning on selling those. Now, for the U.S., a European war would be great. U.S. becomes neutral, and it sells equipment to the Europeans. Yeah, just to understand, 5,000 tanks is basically 12 armored divisions. That's three armored corps, or what Russia calls an armored tank army. That's basically growing to three Russian tank armies. That's a lot of money you can earn. You just got to get the other idiots to go fight and die you for while you're earning that money.
I mean, what is the incentive for Europe to do this? I mean, I got to be honest. From my point of view, that the U.S. will sacrifice Europe in the same way that Europe is sacrificing Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, I don't quite understand why the Europeans don't see that. They're not partners. They were never treated like partners. They're certainly not treated like partners now. And yet, they seem to be very chipper about sending their people to die. And I don't understand their motivation.
Well, the European leaders and the European people are two different things, but a very large, probably the majority of European of your average common man European is a brainwashed moron at this point too. They get so brainwashed by their media, they believe it. I mean, let's look. Everybody says, look, you know, alternative future for Deutschland, for Germany, is 31% of the voter base. Sure, it is. Now let's flip it. 69% vote for the Uno party that wants war. So the majority of Germans still want war, whether they fully grasp that or not. And it's the same thing. The British are even more brainwashed. The French, not much better. Italians are a little less. I mean, the Bulgarians and Romanians won't fight. They'll have a revolution before they fight. And the Greeks. The Romanians, maybe. But the majority of Europeans, particularly Northern Europeans, are brainwashed. But the point here with the leadership is, whose people are they? Okay, follow me on this. Operation Gladio started in 1948, right? Familiar Operation Gladio. Supposedly it ended, and the U.S. kept control over these European NATO countries and neutral countries through terror, through assassination, through bombings, through murder of the wrong politicians, you know, anybody that may be sympathetic to the Soviet Union, or even they tried to kill Charles de Gaulle because de Gaulle wanted to give up Algeria. De Gaulle wanted, you know, de Gaulle was no leftist, but he wanted, you know, normal position with the Soviet Union. We can live with them. So they tried to kill him and his family through some French officers, additionally, the CIA types. You know, he got back at all, and we killed them all. He was a little upset. De Gaulle wasn't the type to sit around, I almost killed my family. It's okay. I forgive you. No, I'm going to kill every last one of you, no matter where the hell you run. I'm going to wipe you out. Oh, he did. He did that. They still gave him a color revolution in the end, but he got back. But so they had, while they had Operation Gladio, which supposedly ended in 92, but I'm questionable about that. Parallel, what they were doing is they were bringing up a new generation of European politicians. You know, they've all studied in the U.S. They've all got, they've been in the open society. And believe you me, Soros is working directly with the deep state. I mean, hell, best of the Soros' right-hand man, for God's sakes. You know, these people, they were bringing up this next generation of European leaders, pushing them forward and getting them into power. And these people have no loyalty to their own people. And they're all got good jobs waiting for them in the U.S. when this is all over. Think tanks, government platforms, yeah, there's plenty. They don't give a damn. They steal what they can. I mean, Ukraine is a laundromat from hell. It's not just Ukraine. Look, the Baltic states were allowing drones to fly through. That makes them already a combatant in this conflict. Latvia it's been reported by Russian intelligence. Latvia is giving 5 of its bases to be used to fly drones out of. That's absolutely now a combatant. Finland's doing the same thing. Russia started electronic warfare, intercepting these drones, turning them around, sending them right back into Latvia and Finland and Estonia. And they just fall somewhere and blow something up, more or less randomly. Well, the European Union is now giving the Baltics 12 billion euro. This was announced yesterday. They're giving them 12 billion euro that were supposed to be earmarked for social spending. Because, you know, grandma doesn't need any more on her pension or a new schoolyard somewhere. And they're giving them these 12 billion euros to the Baltics to deal with these drones. What they're going to do with them, we don't know.
Wait. You said to deal with the drones? They are the ones who are launching the drones.
Right. They're dealing with the drones that Russia's pushing back into their airspace. But what does deal with the drones mean? I think it means... I deal a couple, billion euros to myself, and I deal the rest of the billion euros to van der Leyen and her company. That we've dealt with the drones, you know. That this the money, I mean, war pays. What can you say? There you go.
12 billion euros. You would think that they wouldn't.
Oh yeah. I mean, the whole European Union is just a bankrupt. The EUSSR. Has taken everything that was bad about the USSR and took nothing that was good about the USSR. You know, taking care of the workers, making sure they got vacations, 40-hour work weeks, make sure everybody's got a job. They didn't do that, but they took, let's repress everybody.
Yeah.
And keep our country on going to war. Yeah.
Do you think they crossed it? Well, I guess there are two questions on this. Do you think that do you think that Europe crosses that line? Because
I think so.
There has to be a line somewhere where Russia is like, okay, for example, as you pointed out, if you're producing so many drones and you're sending those drones to overwhelm my defenses, and meaning you've changed battlefield conditions under that guise.
Yep.
Like, does Russia act in that situation? Or is there a line that Europe crosses that Russia will have to act? I'm trying to understand, like, where's the line that is being drawn from the standpoint of Europe? I've seen threats, but does this go beyond threats at a certain point?
Well, Russia is very legalistic. Putin was a lawyer, or is a lawyer by profession. So at this point, Russia is given the legal warning, because we're not at war. Officially, we're not at war. Nobody declared war. So this is a special military operation. So Russia is given the warnings, get out. Because when the strikes come, and I hope they do, I've been saying it from day one, you need to strike. You need to put rationality and the fear of God back into these people.
Right.
And I think it's very proper that Russia said, we're going to go after the elites. You know, you bastards aren't going to get off. We know where you live. We know where your bunkers are. We'll go after you. And the Russian will reach any damn bunker Macron may be building for himself. But anyway, Macron is building a 1,200 square meter or 1,200 square foot, or no, I'm sorry, 12,000 square foot bunker for himself.
Is he?
Oh, yeah. With government money, of course.
Office in 2027. Like 2027 is last year.
Yeah, you got to make it to 2027.
True. True. His wife has a hell of a left hook. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he needs somewhere to hide. Last question, the Iran war. What do you make of that war? Obviously, it is a blunder of all blunders that is going to have negative consequences for the United States going forward for a while. But I'm curious whether or not that affects the Russian war with Ukraine in any particular capacity, short of cost of energy, obviously.
Well, besides the cost of energy, of course, what you're going to get. Well, first of all, you got the famines that are coming. I don't think Europe is going to be like a nationwide famine for the Europeans. I think it'll be a class famine because, you know, I've got a friend and I've interviewed him a couple times. He's a professor of politics up in, let's see, where is he located? Milan, I think, or some, or Turin. Is it Northern Italy? He's saying, you know, and this is 5-6 months ago, he's saying this, before all this started, that the average family in Southern Italy, particularly the more the poor families, they got a lot more month than they got budget. They don't have enough money to feed themselves at the end of the month. And that was before food prices. I mean, look, you know, we're in the calm before the storm. That big dark thing, that's not a cloud. That's the tidal wave. Mm-hmm. That's the shadow of the tidal wave. Food is going to be scarce. I mean, Africa and parts of South America may be in full starvation mode. In Southeast Asia, the poor countries. America, by the way, is going to have is already going to have a big hit. The early harvests are coming in next month. And that's, I think, is going to be the wake-up call. Russia produces 40% of the world's fertilizer. It doesn't use very much because we have black earth. Anything grows in a black earth. The Russian saying is you stick a shovel handle in there, it'll give you a tree. And it's about right. I mean, it is. By the way, this is why, you know, when the rains come, nothing moves because it just turns into quagmire. The type of quagmire you cannot even imagine if you've never been in black earth quagmire. You just sink into it. But everything grows in it. I mean, it's hyper rich soil. But Russia is a producer of 40% of the world's fertilizer. But Qatar is a producer of 30% of the world's chemical fertilizer. The whole green revolution is on the chemical fertilizers, right?
That Qatar tiny is country produced 30% of the world's fertilizer.
Yeah, because there's two things coming in. One, you use gas to produce it. Right. And two, you use ammonia from the gas. You separate the ammonia out, and you use that ammonia for production of ammonia-based fertilizers.
Interesting. Okay.
It uses a lot of gas. But that's why the Europeans can't produce. They haven't been producing their own fertilizers, unless it's, you know, cow crap and pig crap. The chemical fertilizers haven't been produced in Europe since about 2020. Gas got too expensive. Just way too expensive. The 6 years they've been basically, they closed everything down. They've got to import. Well, 30% of the market of the market capacity is gone. Demand is there, but the capacity is gone. Russia is the third largest producer of wheat in the world, about twice what the U.S. produces, but it's the biggest exporter of wheat in the world. Russia feeds a third of the globe, but they can't feed everyone. It's physically impossible. You know, Russia's manufacturing building more fertilizer manufacturer, but that's going to raise another 1, 2, 3 points, and that's all of this year. You need 30% more now. Well, now for the second harvest, maybe the first harvest is already planted. And if you look at U.S. For example, for U.S. farmers, U.S. was importing last year $600 million worth of Russian fertilizer. Yes. That fertilizer is now worth about $1.4 billion. The average farmer can't afford it. Yeah.
Well, fertilizer, 70% of farmers saying they couldn't afford the fertilizer. Yeah.
Fertilizer, and this is, and the U.S. is a rich nation, all things considered. Now you go to an African nation, or you go to a South American nation, or you go Southeast Asia, and you're looking at serious famine. Now for the American neocons, starvation in Southeast Asia is great. Because where are the refugees going to go? They're not going to go to Australia. It's too far away. They're going to go north into China, with the Chinese border. So we'll make problems for China. That's what they're looking at. Guarantee you. They're not saying that, but I guarantee you that's what they're looking at. I saw, you know, a couple tens of millions of people die. Who cares? They're not real people. They're not us. You know, that's the mentality of these people. But, you know, by the way, Mexico buys about $1 billion worth of Russian fertilizer. A lot of that goes to those avocados. Everybody likes a little avocado on toast. Yeah, well, those avocados are going to double in price this year because the fertilizers just went up, double in price. You know, and that's what you're looking at is food prices are going to skyrocket. U.S. imports about 40% of its food. Because it was 40% of its agriculture was key to soybeans and things like that, and corn to export to China. Right? Not, I mean, U.S. makes enough corn for itself that you can't eat it all. but it needs other things, wheat, for example. But it doesn't make that because it was always aimed at China. So now what do? Americans don't eat that many soybeans, for God's sakes. They're not good for you anyway, as far as I'm concerned. But that's beside the point. But that's, you know, what are you going to do? So the U.S. food prices are going to skyrocket as well. Not maybe as much as Europeans, and definitely not as much as Africans, South Americans, Southeast Asians. But they're going to skyrocket. You know, the only countries that are not going to go hungry, well, Russia, obviously. Russian fuel prices and all of this have gone up equivalent of about 10 cents. We produce all the gas, the gasoline and diesel we need, and we export. And we've got all the food we need. We'll feed China for the most part. We got China's back, but we can't, but we can't handle the whole world, obviously. So, yeah, this is a catastrophe. This is a catastrophe that's going to last for years. And Qatar, I will tell you, I mean, I was, besides oil and gas services, the supply chain director, I was director on construction projects, EPC, engineering, right, procurement, construction for oil and gas infrastructure, for an Italian company, Tecnimont. So, and I'll tell you this, I know how long it takes to get the metal construction, the vessels and all that. And considering the destruction in Qatar, those facilities are offline for the next 5 to 7 years.
5 to 7 years. So you're saying that the oil supply, and for that matter, the fertilizer supply, because...
Well, no, not the oil supply, the gas supply.
The gas supply, I'm sorry. Yeah. And the fertilizer
supply. Qatar's gas. Yeah. That's gone. I mean, if you look far enough out, of course, there's going to be new oil fields that'll get opened up and all that. But here's the problem: people don't realize to bring a new oil field to economic fruition is between 3 to 5 years. That's from drilling.
When you look at it, the gas supply is gone for the foreseeable future.
Exactly, and the fertilizer supplies are down. I mean, Russia's not going to be able to build enough manufacturing to cover 30% more of the world's fertilizer supply. It's impossible. And you need it now. Starvation is going to be here this year. And then the question is, what's going to happen when that happens? Right. Hungry people are mean. Hungry people watching their kids starve are really mean. Humanity gets very base when they get hit starvation rations. You know, eat the rich, that may actually occur. People get very, very upset when they don't have anything to eat.
Wow. This has been a fascinating interview, and I have deeply appreciated this conversation. I love your sense of humor. I love the information, the breakdown, all of this stuff. I really appreciate it. And I hope you come back, because I would love to have continued these conversations. Stanislav.
My pleasure.
Kropivnik. Excellent. Man, thank you for this. You be safe, okay?
You too.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
At least I know we've got enough to eat and enough gasoline.
Well, I mean, that's a positive. The food here has been skyrocketing. Like the cost, like gas has gone up to $4.50. Basically on average in regards to Virginia. And Virginia doesn't even have the highest price. I think Ted was paying $5 and some change, like $5.50. Food has gone up big time. Food has gone up big time. Like if you go to like a fast food place or something like that. So.
You know, as a person who lived half his life in the U.S., that's not food.
True.
I'm sorry. The majority of the crap that gets sold in American grocery, that's not food, man. That's chemical cardboard. By the way, you know, GMOs are banned in Russia.
I spent the last year traveling through Asia and Europe. Mm-hmm. And the food is so different. Like they don't even allow much of that stuff in Europe that they allow here in the United States.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And even when you're in other countries, it's just different. The quality is better.
Tastes a hell of a lot better, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on where you are, right? Like in Jakarta, a lot of people didn't eat fast food. Even though those places were there, you know, fish, seafood, those type of things were paramount. Those things were fantastic. Malaysia, there was a lot of fast food in Malaysia, so those people tend to be pretty big. Weirdly enough, because it's like the only Asian country I've been to that people were like Americans. But no, man, it's no, I agree with you. That stuff is not food per se. It's like
it's filler. That's all it is.
It's filler. It's cardboard. But man, I appreciated this. You be safe. Okay. You have a good rest of your day. Have a good one.